Good evening, everybody. Good evening. How are we doing?
Erev Tov.
Erev Tov, too. How many of you here, raise your hands, are sports fans? Wow. Not a lot. Okay, interesting. Yeah, so I'm not in that group really either. I'm happy to watch a game, but I'm not really a big fan. But I've discovered that politics is my sport. How many of you, if you were not here right now, would be watching the debate? Right, that's why I've got it on and Bluetooth while I'm giving the shit. Well, I can't tell you how much I appreciate you giving that up. I know we'll see all the clips on the news later, we'll get the results later. The results may not matter that much of these debates, but I know it is appealing to watch. I watched about 2 minutes just before I left the house, and it's hard to draw yourself away. And we could not be in more stark contrast. Our subject this evening is harmony. But we'll come across a number of debates in Jewish life, in Jewish law, at different periods and different places. And the truth is, though I said that in jest, there is a lot in common about what is being debated on stage and what we're going to be discussing, which is how best to structure society, how best to live a life, how best to aspire to make the world a better place. Should we jump for harmony? Should we aim for utopia? Should we be incremental? Should we be conservative? Should we be progressive? These sound like they are charged political questions, which in our climate, of course, they are. But they're also questions about how to lead one's life. And we're going to be touching on that today. Now, this is the second part of a two-part series, of a two-part set of two classes, made of four, which will conclude our winter monthly series. So I hope by the end of this evening we reach some sort of closure or conclusion. And I realize I've not opened it up to questions and answers. You should feel free at any moment to ask a question, make a critique, tell a personal story or joke. And if you like, at the end I'll leave some time if anyone's got questions. But hopefully we'll resolve most issues, if not with a firm conclusion, at least with a place to stop. So, I always find it helpful at the beginning of a share, a class, or a discussion to have an outline of what we're going to do. It's going to be four parts this evening, conveniently laid out over four pages. The first part, we are going to reinforce who was not at the first half of this class. Okay, so the first page is going to reinforce essentially the bottom line of that class, whether harmony is a Jewish value, and not only a Jewish value, but a biblical value. Now, is there a difference between a Jewish value and a biblical value? Presumably, I just said there is. For example, in our class on dignity, is dignity a Jewish value? Yeah. Did we say it was a biblical value? No, it didn't come up specifically in the biblical text. There was no injunction, there was no instruction, there was no command to be dignified. But it seems to be in the ether of Jewish life, the rabbinic strata of law thought dignity was a massive priority. So it was a Jewish value, but not a biblical one. So we're going to say, part one, we're going to reinforce harmony as a biblical value. Apologies, my assistant has arrived. So, wasn't the assistant I was hoping for. So that's part one. Part two, we're going to look at two major test cases where harmony is not just implicit in biblical law, but it is actually determinative of what the law is. There's an ambiguity in the text. In the biblical text, again, we're getting instructions from God about how to live our life, and there's an ambiguity. And the sages say, how do we know what this means? And the principle of harmony is going to push them in a particular direction which informs how we live. And the two cases we'll see is shaking the lulav. You may not have thought that shaking a lulav was controversial or ambiguous. But every time we lift up those palm fronds, we are in fact instantiating the principle of harmony in our hands. We'll see that. And the second case is levirate marriage. Anyone familiar with levirate marriage? Anyone know the Hebrew term? Or the Yibum. They made a movie about chalitza or something last year, an Israeli movie. It was covered in the press. Anyone know what I'm talking about? What was it called? Yibum? I don't know. But it wasn't actually about Yibum. It was about a cultural issue, but it was, I'm told, good to watch, fascinating. So that's number two, two test cases. Number three, we're going to look at some medieval cases that came up that were not dealt with by the rabbis. Some that deal with Yibum, some that deal with horrific torture scenarios, and others where the principle of harmony came in again. And then the final page, the final phase, the fourth part will be a radical, stunning view on when halacha and harmony collide. And I cannot overstate how radical it is that I even was on the fence as to whether to share it with you. I assume by the time we get up to that in the recording, most people have conked out online, aren't paying attention anymore. But it is an astonishing door opener and loophole that I think makes rabbis quiver. And I'm a rabbi, I quiver occasionally. But any senior rabbis that I've shared this with have kind of bristled and said, no, we don't do that. Put that away. So now that I've teased you with that, we're going to start at the beginning. Page one. Now, I'm sorry, it looks like the sheets, only the front page came out in color. So I can do a little show for you about, I was hoping to induce a sense of peace and harmony with that image. In fact, my vacation last week was to quite the exotic location of Passaic, New Jersey. But my father-in-law subscribes to all these island magazines, and I just need 5 minutes to look through it, and I feel like I've been on vacation. So I'm hoping this helps a little. Now, so we'll start from the beginning. Is harmony a biblical value? Source number one. I also apologize because the gray boxes split them conceptually as well, but hopefully it'll be clear. Source number one. Ashrei Adam Asa Chochma. Happy is the person who finds wisdom, which in our sages' view, wisdom can only mean one thing. What is our body of wisdom culturally? The Torah. What is the Torah? Darachei Darachei Noam V'chol Nativoteha Shalom. Its paths are pleasant and all its walkways are peace. Now, I forgot to mention that I left a teaser at the end of last year. Anyone remember? Good, so I don't have to come back to it. We'll see. Was that anyone did remember? Okay, there was a partial teaser. Hopefully I'll return to it. If you know what I'm talking about and I don't return to it, feel free to mention it before the end. We don't have to talk about it, but it may be helpful. Source number two, the Rambam says, not only is this biblical principle found in Mishlei, in Solomon's work, it's not just a platitude that we care about peace, but actually it is the entire point of Jewish civilization. Last week, was it last week, Parashat Yitro? 2 weeks. Did I give a drush at last Shabbos? it's been a long...
You missed Yitro, you weren't here.
Right, but I did last... I see, right. So 2 weeks ago, we read about Revelation, this stunning event, again, in human history, where God, for the only time... Again, we're used to God's voice because we're readers of the biblical text, but in terms of receiving the divine voice, that only happens once nationally. And that happened 2 weeks ago. And the whole point of that, Rambam says, Gadol HaShalom Shekol HaTorah Nitna Lasot Shalom Ba'olam. The whole point of Torah was to make peace in the world. I said, perhaps somewhat too lightly, that Maimonides here and Miss Universe have something in common when they ask you, what do you want to see? And the answer is always world peace. That's essentially Maimonides' notion of what the Torah is for. At its root cause, the whole point of the Torah is to institute peace in the world, and its basis is our Pasuk from Mishlei. Now the Ralbag in Source 3 takes this even further in a way that is going to start to make us question a little more. Because the Rambam writes, writ large, the Torah is about making peace, which I think we can all get on board with, I hope. But the Ralbag is going to suggest that actually the Torah's purpose is not just world peace and harmony made over time, but something very personal. The paths of Torah are pleasant and incredibly sweet la'adam, to the human person. Because the Torah does not burden anybody with anything that is too hard for them. Aval kol ma sheba min hamitzvot v'hazharot, everything that is a command and a warning and a prohibition and an injunction, all these things, hem dvarim arevim, these are pleasant and sweet, v'ritzuyim ba'atzmutam, and meaningful in their essence. V'chol netivot ha-Torah hem shalom, and all the paths of Torah are peace. And now listen to this, ki kulam yashiru, all of them lead, el briot ha-guf u-briot ha-nefesh, to physical health and spiritual health. The entirety of Torah, every prohibition, every transgression, every command is to lead to a sense of physical and spiritual equilibrium and health. Now that is something I think we can all get on board with as an aspiration. Do we all feel that in life? I'll leave that floating out there for us to consider. This doesn't, by the way, on the face of it, we should say, when we say happiness and harmony, that doesn't mean necessarily instant gratification. Me getting up in the morning to get to Shacharis on time may not feel happy in the moment, but maybe it does lead to physical health, because it is healthier to get up and be driven and have a mission-filled day and not to laze about, maybe. So we have to be careful when we say the Torah is about peace and harmony and happiness. It doesn't mean whatever we want, but it means promoting a healthy, physically and spiritually, and happy lifestyle. So we may still have questions, but that's what the Rabbah seems to suggest. Now, there are two examples I'm going to bring, sources 4 and 5, where there are biblical commandments that on their face don't seem to have anything in common with harmony. In fact, may seem the opposite. But actually, the Sefer HaChinuch, a medieval figure, anyone who wrote the Sefer HaChinuch? Correct. We do not know who wrote the Sefer HaChinuch. But he provides a lot of reasoning behind what the mitzvot are for. He takes all 613, actually, between Menachem Arav during the week. I'm going through one by one. And there are about 15 on the Halachot of Pesach. And by number 14, when he says, what's the reason for this? He says, it's all Pesach. You know the reason, it's all the same. But here he has some interesting ideas. Number 4. This is Mitzvah 239, Reish Lamed Tet. Mitzvah Tochacha Li Yisrael. There is a command. What is Tochacha? To rebuke. There is an instruction for us, each of us as individuals, to rebuke those, She'enu Nag Shura, people who don't behave well. It's not just a nice thing to do. We have an obligation to rebuke people. Now, does that sound like it's got anything to do with harmony? Right. No. It sounds like it could be quite the opposite. It could be quite problematic, but something we need to do nonetheless to assure legal behavior, to ensure the problems of cultural erosion don't occur. So, lahochiach echad mi Yisrael sheinu minaheg shura, there is an obligation to reprove and rebuke people, ben dvarim shben adam l'chaveira u ben adam l'makom, whether they are interpersonal issues or interdimensional between man, woman, and God, l'fishi yesh bazeh shalom v'tovo ben ha'nashim, and the reason for this is because it makes peace between people. How does this make peace between people? We don't have to read everything inside, I'll tell you. How does this make peace? Me rebuking, how does that make peace? Think about the long term. If there's somebody in shul, somebody at home, who's constantly doing the wrong thing, and you say, I'm not going to make a fight, what do I need to fight? What do I need to make a whole scene about? I'm going to keep quiet. Okay, so there's peace for that day. Long term, what's going to happen?
It gets under your skin and bothers you.
It gets under your skin and bothers you. And what will eventually happen? It'll get out of your skin and bother everybody else, right?
Make him or she a better person.
So this is a second level, right? Again, he's not the last word on what these mitzvot are about. But he's going to make the argument that rebuke is about peace, because actually it's about maintaining the psychological health of everybody. And you can let it go for one day and you're all in peace because you're not fighting. But if you don't say something now in a gentle way, it will eventually explode in a non-gentle way, and then you've ruined everything. There is no peace, there's no harmony, you just can't look at each other anymore because you shout it. This is generally good advice, I think, when you have something that bothers you. If it's something that you think will metastasize over time, if it's, you know, somebody chews with their mouth open at the table, and you think, oh, I'm going to say something now, or I'm going to explode in 10 years. A heads up, most people don't change their eating habits. So if I were you, I'd just let that get under the skin and, you know, go and punch a wall afterwards. By the way, you know there's a condition to find other people's eating habits irritating. If you look at, I can't remember what it's called, maybe the physicians in the room can tell me, there is a condition. Sometimes I find things irritating, and I was told that it's a condition. We looked it up. Apparently 80% of people have this condition. At which point, it is no longer a condition. There you go. It's called marriage. So at this point, when 80% of the human public have it, it's not a condition. It's just the human condition. It's harmony. We all get irritated by it. That's fine. Exactly. I mentioned this in a drasha a few weeks ago. It was Dostoevsky said about the figure who loves humanity but can't stand human beings and wants to sacrifice himself for the good of the world, but he can't spend 24 hours with another person because they blow their nose too loudly or they chew too loudly. It's just the human condition. Either way, there are some things that it's not worth sitting down every day and saying, look, there's a mitzvah to rebuke. I need to tell you, you shouldn't eat like that. That's not going to go well. But if there are major things that you see people are transgressing spiritually or interpersonally, that you think that actually, constructively, you can make a point, find a gentle way to do it earlier, and the mitzvah is to stop an explosion later. That's his idea. Number five, he's got another rule. If somebody kills somebody by mistake, what happens? Jail, capital punishment, what happens? Excellent. So, colloquially, you're right, and I said this another time and someone corrected me, so it was a little bit of a trap. If somebody kills somebody by mistake, it's a mistake. You have to live with it, but if it's onus, if it's a mistake, it's a mistake. If you kill somebody unintentionally, you get Ari Miklat, and those are two different gradations. There are mistakes in the world that you can't control, and there's unintentional things where in theory I could have controlled, but it wasn't on purpose. You make that distinction in American law by talking about murder and manslaughter, right? People kill other people completely by mistake, which is not manslaughter because it was completely out of their control. But manslaughter is when there's a level of negligence or responsibility, but obviously you didn't mean to harm this person. So if you kill somebody unintentionally, you go to Ir Miklat, which is a city of refuge. Why? First, let's lay this out. If you kill somebody unintentionally, there are a number of cities of refuge scattered all over the land of Israel, again in our hypothetical halachic state, to which you would then have to flee quite fast as you possibly can. And how long do you stay in that city of refuge? Until the high priest dies. So, and the high priest, the Gemara, the Chazal, are quite well aware that people are sitting there praying for the high priest to kind of kick the bucket so they can go free. And there are all sorts of institutions to make sure that Ari Miklat doesn't sit there having collective, you know, asifas, everyone getting together Sunday mornings to pray for the death of the high priest. But that's how long they stay. Who else lives in the Ari Miklat? Levim live around the outskirts. And who lives in the middle? Just other unintentional murderers. That's how you spend the rest of the high priest's life. And if he just got into office and he's a young man, you could be looking at quite a long time. Why? Why do you have to go to the city of refuge? Why is that a fitting punishment? It's a refuge. It's a safe haven from what? Now this is odd. The Jewish halachic system is hardline against vigilante justice, with a number, well, a couple of exceptions. One being, if somebody kills somebody unintentionally, their family have the legal right to kill the unintentional killer, which is astonishing. You would expect if somebody murdered intentionally, you might make that dispensation, but we don't. The court has to deal with that. If somebody does it unintentionally, the family has the right to follow them. So that's why it's called the city of refuge. So they can flee and hide because they're protected there. They can't be killed in the city of refuge. And there are all sorts of discussions in the Talmud about what happens if you're running along, what happens if he's sitting on a tree and the bottom of the tree is in the city of refuge and the top of the tree is not in the city of refuge. And you've got all these families camped out on these nice little portable homes near the edge with a bow and arrow waiting for them just to lean out of the city of refuge. What's the status? So you've got long rabbinic discussions on that level. But what's Ari Miklat? Safe haven. That's one view. He has another couple of views. He says, Second line, he says, Ra'ui, after the ellipses, V'lachen, Ra'ui l'mi shahareg afilu shogeg. It is fitting for somebody who killed, even unintentionally, Mikivin Shabbat takala gedola kazu al yado, because something so horrific has occurred by their hand, even if it was unintentional. It's fitting that they should suffer. They should be punished for that. Sheyitztaya, again, unintentional is not the same as unavoidable. It's not the same as accidental. Those completely accidental, you don't have to. This is unintentional. You were the example given in the Gemara. You know an example is given in the Gemara? If you are tiling a roof in the opposite way than usually you would, which is more negligent, it might be more convenient and easier, but it's more likely for tiles to fall off and something falls off and kills a person, that's b'shogeg. Meaning, you never intended for this, but you were doing something that you know was a little bit dodgy, and that's unintentional. So again, there's some culpability. And here he's saying that you would have to suffer. She yitztaya alead tsar galut. You have to suffer exile. Sheshakul kimat, which is only a little bit of the measure. Kitzar mita, like the pain of death for this person. Shenifrad ha'adam me'o avav me'eretz maladeto. This person, you exiled them from their family. They can't spend time with their family or their friends. They had ambitions, they had goals, they had aims, they had life to live. And you cut that short. And you have to feel that sense of exile. We're not going to kill you. But you have to live in a place that is not around your friends and your neighbors. You're not going to be able to commute to work. Your whole life will be upended. That's one reason he gives. Va'od. Of a shochin kol yamavim zarim, you spend your whole life living with strangers. Of a od yesh tikun ha'olam b'mitzvah, there's also something positive here. This isn't just punishment. Something positive. Kamosha ba'akatov, as the verse explains, sheyinasel imzer miyad goel hadam. That the what's the English translation of goel hadam? Redeemer of blood, thank you. The family who have the right to kill you will not be able to kill you. But then this last one, Va'od to'elet badavar. But there is another purpose here. Leval yiru krove hamakeh et harotzech le'enehem. That the surviving family members of the person who died shouldn't have to look at you. They shouldn't have to see your face. They shouldn't have to be reminded of that death blow every time they see you. So psychologically, you have to go elsewhere. We are taking you out of their line of sight. And this is because the Torah is about peace and pleasantness. Again, Ari Miklat on its face is not really about peace. It's about mitigating bloodshed. Just go and hide. But actually, this is about, again, tempering psychologically society. Making sure that people who have suffered inexplicable tragedy don't have to relive that and re-see that all the time. In fact, yep. It seems like an arbitrary measure, and it is an interesting... It deserves its own study, let's put it that way. But yeah, it could happen that a week later you're out, or a day, it could be an hour. There's actually a discussion, what happens if during the court proceedings you're pronounced guilty, but they haven't actually sent you out to Ari Miklat yet, and then the high priest dies in between. That's got to be a frustrating moment for somebody, right? But yeah, you have to discuss these. Meaning, is that better than 20 years? How do you quantify pain? And this is, and I guess one could say elegant or inelegant, depending on how you look at it. Certainly, it appears arbitrary way of quantifying how long you're there. It's fair for everybody. You've all got the same risks, per se. And it's not like someone sitting there cooking up. You know, last week we had a sentencing memo that went back and forth. 7 to 9, 3 to 4. Who said that 7 is equivalent? Who's quantifying this stuff? So you've got to pick a way, and this is the way they chose in this case. In fact, in the anyone here subscribe to the New Yorker? If this is a giveaway of your political affiliation and you don't want to, feel free not to. But there's some proud political affiliations here. About 2017, I think it was, a lady called Alice Gregory wrote a piece called "The Sorrow and Shame of the Accidental Killer." She's in her 70s. And she wrote a piece about how when she was in her young 20s, she was driving to go off to college, and she was going through some of these winding streets out in the country. She was getting to the house she was going to live in, a sorority house. I think they were redecorating. And as she was driving, a little kid came on his bike into the street, and she ended up knocking the bike and killing the child. And she begins the piece writing about how hopeful she was about her life. She was off to college, the first in her family to make it. She was dreaming of her career, her vocation, her studies, her friends, and that moment on the road changed her life. And nobody, of course, it's horrific for the family who loses this child, and she was writing in apologetics, but also speaking about the psychological trauma she's carried with her for 45 years. You had to live with the fact that, you know, if you're a murderer and you're a murderer, you got to live with that. If it was totally accidental, you have some ways of justifying to yourself. If it's, maybe I wasn't focusing enough on the road. Maybe it was too fast. Maybe there's something. If you entertain these acts and you live with the trauma that you're responsible for other people's pain, for somebody else's death, how do you cope with that? And she actually started a movement to get psychological literature out on this, because there are thousands of people who this happens to and that they happen to all the time. You can look her up, Alice Gregory. She's got a website and resources for people, but she writes in very moving terms about living with the psychological trauma of being the killer. And Ari Miklad, in some sense, gives you a place. She actually talks about Ari Miklad in the piece. I don't know if she's Jewish, but who are you living with? Other people who went through that. You're living with strangers, but strangers who you can talk about having been through the same trauma with. These are not murderers. You're not in a town of criminals. You're in a town of people who are under the stress and weight of psychological trauma that have left a trail of pain across the country. And you get to be with each other and talk with each other. And she actually recommends groups where people do talk to each other about this. Oh my gosh, it's 8:48. Okay, we're nearly done with part one. Now, bottom of the page, source number six. So far, we've only seen cases where biblical law enshrines harmony implicitly. Are there cases where on its face there seems to be mitzvot? And I'll throw this out a little bit to the crowd. Think of a mitzvah that seems on its face to entail pain, that doesn't seem to be promoting pure harmony and ease, making life healthy.
Bris.
Interesting. Yeah, there's pain involved with that. Certainly for the baby, usually for the parents, often for the rabbi who's kind of hiding, not really looking. In fact, there's a view. In Israel, they say shechianu at a bris. In Chutz La'aretz, we don't say shechianu at a bris. And there's a view that that's precisely how can we say shechianu when the baby's in pain. And we have to be attuned to the fact that though this is a celebration of the baby entering the covenant, it is painful. Okay, so that's one example. Are there any others?
Pesach.
Pesach! Yeah, there's a great apron my grandmother has. I think it says, for this we left Egypt. Yeah.
Fasting
seems to be about inflicting pain precisely. Inui hanefesh. Say again.
I was going to say
vini tem nefshotechem. Yeah, it is about afflicting yourself. There seems to be moments where afflicting the self is commanded. And I guess in those cases you can talk about it promoting longer term health. You afflict yourself in terms of fasting for a day to make you more self, more reflective and more healthy spiritually, psychologically, physically going forward. There is one in particular, the Meshech Chochma notes, which is counterintuitive to some degree. The mitzvah to have children. Children are a blessing. No question about that. Giving birth to children, I cannot speak from my own experience, but I'm told, can hurt a little. Yes, I'm told it can hurt. It can be painful. So the Meshech Chochma says, precisely for this reason, there is no mitzvah for women to have children. Only men. You think it's a patriarchal thing? It's about, I don't know what one thinks. One could say, oh, only the men are given mitzvot, which is a separate discussion. But at least in this mitzvah, women are not commanded to have children because of the, from a man's perspective, unimaginable pain that it entails. How could God say, I demand that you put yourself through this pain? Thankfully, we live in an age when medical technology has meant that there's immense pain, but also fantastic odds that one doesn't undergo horrific circumstances. 300 years ago, that was not the case. For the rest of human history, that was not the case. Commanding a woman to have children would be the equivalent of saying, I want you every few years to go 50-50 on your survival. My wife and I just started watching something, Poldark. Anyone see Poldark? Anyone heard of Poldark? It's on Amazon Prime. It's about a British soldier who survived the rebellion, the revolution, and he somehow made it back to England, to Cornwall. And we haven't done the calculation, that we've only watched an episode and a half, but I'm pretty sure 45% of it is mainly music and people riding on horses. That's mainly what we've seen so far. I thought if we could edit out all the conversation, just have music and horses, be about 30 minutes of my life so far. But it's beautiful photography against the ocean and the hills and the chalk cliffs, etc. But they're going to the marketplace to buy food. And I'm just thinking, thank God for grocery stores. They're just grabbing food off the floor. You don't know where it's been, what's on it. It's fish that kind of looks like maybe it's salted, maybe it's deadly. I don't know. People are living in ways which, again, to transport that to the medical field, my wife's watching a different thing called Call the Midwife or something. I don't know if anyone saw that. She keeps trying to make me watch it, but I haven't watched it yet. But again, the medical technology has made life unimaginably easier. And here the Meshech Chochma says, we don't have to read it again, but he's saying the Torah refuses to insist that we do anything. We'll read one line from him, the second line. Darachei Noam v'chol nativoteha shalom, the whole of Torah, all its paths, all its walkways, all its tributaries are about peace and pleasantness. V'lo amsa al Yisraeli, and it does not burden a Jew, ma she'ein b'yicholet haguf lekabel, something which the body cannot take. And he says, that's why there's only, how many times do we have to fast a year, biblically? How many fasts do we have to do a year?
One,
Yom Kippur. There are other fasts, but they're rabbinic. There's only one biblically mandated fast. Because the human body wouldn't be able to take much more than that, is his suggestion. He says, and actually gives a very precise saying, the idea of physical intimacy is not prescribed against anybody. Celibacy is not endorsed by Jewish law, with one exception, which was Moshe Rabbeinu. At some point was told that he couldn't engage in physical intimacy because of his unique status. But he says that's one of the reasons why we cannot be prescribed, and there can be no insistence that we avoid physical intimacy because the human body wouldn't cope. Yeah?
What about the mitzvah that you have to give up your life and not be over on three mitzvahs? How does that fit into this?
So that's a good point. Because the big three, or big four, as the case might be, where we're told one has to give up their life for the greater picture, we'd have to talk about that in a separate context. But yeah. This is precisely the point, and actually I specifically mentioned the physical intimacy because I was leaning towards the thing I mentioned last time, which is, hold on a minute, you're telling me the Torah is only about making us healthy and making us happy and giving us harmony on every level. Are there any exceptions? We have to kill ourselves. We don't have to kill ourselves. We're never allowed to kill ourselves. We are meant to die rather than transgress on occasion. I'm sure we can come up with solutions to why that doesn't fall in breach of this. But the case I mentioned last time, homosexuality, there are people who we are saying can never have physical intimacy by biblical law. And what we've just read is the Torah would never demand that of a person because it's unattainable. It's unconscionable to imagine living a life where you repress the need, the urge, the necessity for physical intimacy, because the Torah is about shalom and ne'imah. I'm not about to say anything radical, other than there seems to be a tension here. And that's why I specifically mentioned the Meshech Chochma, and we'll talk more about this as we continue, but so far, at least in principle, what we're getting is the Torah is about peace and having pleasant life, having physical health, spiritual, everything is about cultivating the best of us physically and spiritually. Now we can turn the page under page 2. We're not going to get to read all of this in detail. You may be relieved to know. But we'll do some. Two cases. Top of the page, above the thorns and underneath the thorns. Now, what do we have to hold in our hands? Every sukkah. Four species. Anyone know what they are? The etrog. What's the etrog? An etrog. Anyone know what the etrog is? Does it have an English name? Just a citron? I thought that was a car. Okay, so you got a Citroen. If I went to a store and I just said, do you have any Citroens? They'd fetch an Etrog for me?
Fairway.
A Fairway? Well, Fairway they can see, they know what I'm looking for. Okay, interesting. So you've got a Citroen, you've got three other things.
Myrtle.
Willow and?
Palm.
Palm. Anyone ever seen a palm tree?
Sure.
Anyone ever seen a lulav on a palm tree? No. Did I say yes? Did someone say yes? Yeah, where's the lulav?
In the center.
You've been in the middle of a palm tree?
I have a smaller
bush.
Oh, you have a smaller palm tree. Right. So, in the biblical verse that says we have to take these things, there's a level of ambiguity. Source 7. L'kachtem lachem b'yom ha'rishon. You shall take on the first day. Pre-Eitz Hadar. The fruit of a goodly tree. What fruit is that?
Citron.
Well, that's the citron, right? But there's a level of ambiguity. And the rabbinic sages try to figure out how does that verse unambiguously mandate that I need to hold the citron. Again, it may seem like the stakes are low because we're talking about plant life, ritual life. We're not talking about life and death. But the assumption is that every biblical mandate is high stakes. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God is giving me an instruction about how to attain heaven in the world to come and to make earth a perfect place. There shouldn't be ambiguity. If God tells me to do something, I shouldn't think, the fruit of a goodly tree, I got very pretty apples here. So the sages are under immense pressure to tell us how this verse tells us unambiguously that if I pick up a citron, I fulfilled a biblical mandate. Because if it's just maybe, if it was just a maybe, what would we see in Borough Park? You'd have people, you've seen people have two sets of tefillin, Rabbeinu Tam and Rashi, because they're not sure. Can you imagine if we weren't sure which fruit? You'd have a line of people picking up apples and pears and oranges to cover every possible reading. But we have a biblical mandate that's clear. Chazal, the sages say, there is no question. Pre-Eitz Hadar means the Etrog. And they have four or five different reasons. Hadar doesn't just mean pretty, but it means Hadar, which lives on the tree from year to year. There are different readings. Now, Kapot Marim, which means the branches of palm trees. Now, other than Jay, who's been inside a palm tree, most of us would say, what kind of branch is this? If I were just instinctively to go up to a palm tree and take a branch, it would look more like a palm tree branch that you see in Florida or Tel Aviv. Probably in LA as well, I don't know.
Yes.
Probably anywhere south of here. They have it where they're debating now in South Carolina, they have trees. Where is South Carolina? It's under North Carolina, south of it. Is that below Georgia? Touching Georgia?
Yes.
I knew it. There you go. All right, it's getting warm. So, how do we know it means lulav? The palm fronds that we hold. There's more to say in that pasuk, but look in the next source 8. Second line, Amalei Ravina la Rav Ashi. Ravina says to Rav Ashi, Mimai, how do I know, Dehai Kapot Tamarim, that those palm branches, do lulavahu, are referring to the lulav? And again, we may feel instinctively, this is a bit arcane, why do you need to debate this? We'll pick a leaf and we'll fling it about. But the stakes for the sages are incredibly high. Tell me don't murder, tell me pick up a palm branch. This has the same level of obligation on me as a human being to follow the will of God. Now I need to know what you mean. Don't murder. I know what that means. Although I need more explanation, again, as I actually mentioned on Shabbat, about what about war? What about self-defense? What about all sorts of cases? I need explanation. Tell me what to do and what not to do. Now you're telling me to pick up a branch. What kind of branch? How do I know it's a lulav? A macharuta. Maybe it means the hard branches. Again, I'm not a... what are the people who do trees called? Horticulturist does plants. There's something arbora. Yes, I'm not. As you can hear, I'm none of those things. But I've seen a tree, and there are hard branches that, when you go down to Florida or Tel Aviv, you see the big palm branches that hang out. I've not picked any up, but you try to kind of bond those things together in the middle. It doesn't really go. They're stiffened and they're hardened. You try and bend it in, they kind of break. They're stuck. How do you know I'm not meant to be waving those palm branches around? Be'ena, the answer is be'ena kapot veleka. You need them to be bound in, kapot marim. They're saying the word palm branches, kapot doesn't just mean branch, it also means bound. And they're doing a double reading to get to an unambiguous meaning. So it can't be bound in, it can't be that. Okay. Ve'ema ufta, maybe it means the trunk. Maybe we need to go around cutting down palm trees and picking up trunks. If you think it's hard to carry the Hoshanas, the Machsa, and your Lulav, try and do that with a trunk. Then maybe that's what it means, because it's not spread out. Right? If you need it to be bound in, the trunk's all in.
Is it possible it's kaput? Kaput is a bond.
So kafut is bound in, you're saying? Yeah, kafut is the secondary reading. Kapot means branches, but they're saying kafot also means kafut. You have to read it in the secondary way to mean bound, otherwise we're left stuck with an ambiguity.
Somebody is shackled,
he's
kafut.
Kafut? Not kaput. He's kaput, but he's also kafut. Correct. So ve'im ofta, maybe it's the trunk. Kafut michlal de'ikaparud. If you need it to be bound, the implication is it needs to be bindable. And a trunk is just stuck inward. It is just naturally bound. You can't unbind a trunk. I need something that can be bound and unbound. Okay, so the stiff, hard branches don't work because they don't bind in. The trunk doesn't work because it doesn't bound out. Okay, we're getting through, again, through putting immense interpretive pressure on the word kapot, to kafot, to kaput. We're getting to a place where we have an unambiguous instruction from the biblical text. Okay, but it's not those two things yet. Ve'ema kufra, right, the third line towards the end. Ve'ema kufra, so maybe it means the branches at the root of the palm tree. Again, I'm not an expert, but I'm told that these branches at the bottom of the palm tree, these roots, are sometimes thorny, hence the thorn through the middle of your page. They're very sharp and thorny. Maybe that's what it means. And if that's what it means, that's what we've got to put. Now, can you imagine, it comes to Sukkot, you're picking up your etrog upside down, and you're picking up this thorn thing, and you've got to do it. Now, would that be unimaginable to us? I mean, it would be because we don't do it, but would it be inconceivable that God would make us do that?
That would be painful.
It would be painful. But as we've said, there are painful things in Jewish life. I get up every morning for Shacharis. There's a bris. We try to have children. There are painful things.
It would be a little incongruous
with
the mitzvah of our meaning, which is bringing all harmony together. It's bringing our meaning together. I mean, that's a little bit of drush, but...
So let's say we're doing drush and forget everything we know about Sukkot and Jewish life. The mitzvah was to pick up this thorn bush. If I were to say, give me a drush, what do I do with this? How do I justify the fact I have to pick up a thorn thing? What would you say? There are difficult people in the world. There are people who are thorny, and we've got to come all together. It's not just enough the ones who don't smell nice. You've got to have people who hurt you. Meaning, we could make something out of it, right? But despite that, Amar Abaya, Abaya says, inconceivable. Impossible. He could have said at this point, we have a tradition from Moses at Sinai that it means the lulav in the middle of Jay's tree. That's what it means. But he doesn't say that. He says it is inconceivable. I've got an ambiguity in the verse. I don't know if I'm meant to pick up the root or the lulav. These are opposite ends of the tree. I don't know what to do. And we don't have anybody doing chumras, picking up the roots. Because it is inconceivable that God would mean that. Why? Darachea darachei Noam. Because the Torah is pleasant, v'chol netivotei shalom, and its ways of peace. One second, look at Rashi. Rashi says, ve'ilu asuyin kekotzin, and those have all these thorns in them, v'yotzin ben uksin harbe, lots of little brambles, u'mesartin et yadayim, it would cut your hands. It is inconceivable that God would make us hurt ourselves to fulfill a mitzvah. And on that basis, again, at least the way it's presented in the Talmud, in the Gemara, on that basis alone, nobody's doing chumras. No one's picking up the roots. We have an unambiguous text. It says, kapot tamarim, branches of palm. Which branches? Not the hard ones, not the trunk, not the roots. And we've got textual reasons to say it shouldn't be the hard branches and it shouldn't be the roots. But the only reason we have to say, sorry, the trunk, the only reason we have to say it's not the root is the value of harmony. That's it. And this is one of the two cases where Chazal are looking at the biblical text and saying, I don't know what God means, but he's given me a value that tells me I know without question what he means. He cannot possibly want me to do something that involves hurting myself. Impossible. Yeah.
There's two issues. One is, are we deciding what is inconceivable to us, and then we're reading that into what God is telling us? Or are we saying that what God is telling us, it's inconceivable that what God is telling us wouldn't hurt us, and therefore we accept that as this is something that's pleasant, even though it might seem hurtful to us. We accept that God would not do that.
It's an interesting point. To some degree, I think it's the same thing. Meaning, the rabbis are making a judgment here.
But they're not making a drush based on that. And that's how, there's a tradition of Torah Sheba'al Peh that tells them what the...
Oh, okay. I see what you're saying. Yes, it's highly possible that Chazal have got a tradition from Moses on Sinai that it's a lulav. But they don't say that in the text. So either that's not the case, or that is the case, but they didn't want to share that with us. They wanted to teach us something else, which is, we could have just told you, it's just a tradition, stop asking questions. But I want you to know that irrespective of that tradition, you don't have to start doing chumras because we've got a tradition, tell all your communities, spread it far and wide, put up a thing on the internet, there's no machloket, it's a tradition from Moses. But when you teach your children, when you teach your communities, when you share this, tell them the reason we know is because it's inconceivable that God would want to hurt us. So you could kind of sit in the middle on that. However one slices it, the text doesn't say it's a tradition. The text says it's because it's inconceivable otherwise. So they're trying to promote an ideology where a central value of the halachic system is saying, I've got a biblical ambiguity, I'm not sure what it means, it must mean this because of harmony. And what's going on halachically, mechanically, in the background, I don't know. But this is what they're teaching. Yeah.
Or they're just explaining, you know, and saying that it's not just a tradition and you're ignoring it. They're saying, this is what we know what it is from Malach Moshe Sinai. And they're explaining what makes this, you know, Dachi Noam and why this is pleasant.
I agree. I don't want to overstate. They're not saying we're ignoring it, but they neglect, meaning they could have very, let's put it this way. Rabbis are not known for their brevity, right? Talmud is not a short set of volumes. They could have quite easily have said, and often will say, Halach L'Moshe M'Sinai. For example, when it comes to Rosh Hashanah, why do we blow shofar on Rosh Hashanah? Anybody know why shofar Rosh Hashanah? Very straightforward answer. Because the Torah tells us to. The Gemara says, why do we blow shofar on Rosh Hashanah? And what does the Gemara say? Why are you asking? The Torah says to. Then it says, oh, I know that, but I'm asking you why the Torah wants us to. It could have quite easily have said here, how do you know it's a lulav? Because the Torah says. I know the Torah says that, but give me some more ideas. But it doesn't do that. It expresses it in a way to make Darchei Noam appear like a central cog in the halachic mechanics. That there's an ambiguity. We're going to use harmony to determine what it means. We'll move on to the next case, but I don't think I've resolved the issue, but at least enough that we can move to the next case. So, levirate marriage. Let's do some of the basics. We're not going to do any of the basics. Let's go over some of the basics quickly. Two brothers, represented by my two fingers. One of them has a big simcha, gets married. They are not blessed with children, and the brother passes away. Maybe I should use other fingers. I don't know how. Oh, that will be the brother. The brother passes away. What does the wife, the widow, now have to do? Has to either marry or do chalitza. Either do yibum, levirate marriage, or do chalitza, which involves what? Shoes and spit and reading. Yes, it's one of these things that is relatively rare in halachic life, that there is a chalitza or yibum for that matter performed. And in various segments of the community, when there's a rare mitzvah happening, there'll be a big email this go around saying, oh, there's a mitzvah happening, everyone should come watch. And when it's like pigeon chamor and they're redeeming a donkey or something, the donkey probably doesn't get all camera shy and say, why are all these people with big beards and black hats watching me? And think, oh, this is the most attention I ever got in my life. This is fantastic. I'll be redeemed again. But when it's a young lady who suffered the loss of her husband and has to go through a somewhat demeaning ritual of spitting into a shoe, and you have 100 people in stadium seating watching you spit, it can be a little bit off-putting. You can YouTube it. There are videos of women doing chalitza, and the spit, there are rabbinic definitions of what that spit needs to look like, how much it needs to be, and the one that we were doing Yavama in YU when I was there, and there was a video they showed us, and this woman was in the room. Again, they had like told everyone on the street in the Kola, come watch, come, everyone comes in, and she picks up the shoe and she spits. But this is rabbinic law, so it's, they pick up the shoe, say, again, because it wasn't enough, because she's nervous, and you know, it's not easy, to, unless you're a football player, it's not easy to spit in public at the best of times. You get nervous, and now you have to do it again. So it can, again, does that sound like harmony? We're not doing each mitzvah in the Torah right now and how it fits. But it should raise a question for us. Either we have to say, yes, it is harmony, or we have to redefine what we think harmony is when we say the Torah is about harmony. Okay, we have 3 minutes. Okay, so levirate marriage. The case was, two brothers married, the brother passes away when they don't have children. Let's say, happy days, two brothers, one gets married, big simcha, another simcha, has a child. Then unfortunately, the brother passes away, so you've got the mother and the child left. Does she have to do Yibum Chalitza? No. Why? She has a child. So what does she do? She goes through the mourning process, she grieves, she finds comfort, and she says, I'm going to remarry. And she goes to remarry, and then tragedy strikes her again, and the child passes away. She now no longer has a child from that marriage to the husband. Does she now have to do Yibum or Chalitza? Because now, in theory, she doesn't have a child from that marriage. How are they going to continue his legacy? What's your instinct?
No.
Why not? So, she got married, but you're saying, let's say 10 years go by and she never remarried and the child died, would she have to do it?
No.
Why not? So it's not the marriage then, what is it?
Her age.
Meaning her age, she's got older.
The fact there was a child.
But then the child passed away. Let's put it this way. Let's read the pasuk. The pasuk says, I'm sorry, we may have to push past a little bit. Ki yeshvu achim yachdav. If there are two brothers together, umeit echad mehem uvein ein lo, and then one of them dies, uvein ein lo. How do you translate those three words for me? And he is without son. He doesn't say, and he didn't have a son. Doesn't say he never had. Just says three words that are somewhat ambiguous. He is without child. So 10 years later, the child passes away, the mother's sitting there, that man who passed away is without child now. There is an ambiguity here about whether she now needs to go and do Yibum or Chalitza. It doesn't say, and they never had a child together, it says, and he is without child. He is now in 2020, he passed away in 2010, they had a child, the child passed away now, 2020, he's without child. Maybe she has to do Yibum or Chalitza. But in the sense that we believe in the afterlife, he's still an entity and he is now without child.
And no one's life is forever.
Correct. And because no one's life is forever, we believe that everything's eternal. And he has no child to carry on his legacy. I think instinctively we all feel, yeah?
But what's the time frame that pasuk refers to?
Correct.
The moment of death, he had no child?
That's exactly the question. There's an ambiguity. What is the time frame? And we're going to skip a lot of the text, and I'll tell you the bottom line. The Gemara says, it is inconceivable that God would want to disrupt a new marriage, or 10 years down the line, crop up all this psychological baggage. It must mean, at the time of death, they had no children. It's impossible to imagine any other way. We're going to wrap up in 2 minutes, so apologies. I think we have a minion. So we have the second case study. Again, there's more to say on each of these cases, and there's a lot more to say beyond this. Maybe we'll have to do another installment, but I don't want to push the limit. But what we have so far is two case studies where there is a biblical ambiguity, and whether it is an ambiguity or the rabbis want to present it as such, it is presented as a biblical ambiguity that we don't know what to do, and the only way to resolve this for the sages is by saying it is inconceivable that God would want to do something, and they use this pasuk, Darachei Noam v'chol nativoteha shalom. If we are promoting the Torah, if we are told by King Solomon that the Torah is about peace and harmony, it is impossible, just inconceivable. It cannot be the text means that. And we define unambiguously, again, we don't have chumras here. We don't have women or beis dins that insist that 10 years later, if a child falls away, the woman goes to, there's no chumra. It is determined to be the singular meaning of the text. It cannot mean something that is unharmonious or unpleasant. I'm sorry to do this to you, but we're going to continue another time because I don't want to stretch your limit or move the minion again.